Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. We are coming to you from Midtown Manhattan. Our guest is Alice Paillard, co-director of Champagne Bruno Paillard. Alice will help us navigate through all things champagne. We will also taste the Paillard Champagne for our weekly wine sip later in the show. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Okay, there are many sparkling wines made around the world, but what makes champagne champagne? What grapes are used for champagne? What is disgorgement? What is the difference between a vintage and a non-vintage champagne, also known as a multi-vintage, which we'll find out about? What is dosage? We'll get into all of that and more with our expert guest, Alice Paillard, because this is the Champagne Show. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Alice.
Thanks, Sam. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. Alice is co-director of Champagne Bruno Paillard, located in the Champagne region of France. Little background. Her ancestors have been growers in Champagne since 1704. In 1981, Alice's father, Bruno Paillard, at the young age of 27, broke the traditional mold and famously went on to found his own champagne house. Now, he didn't just grow the grapes, which his predecessors did. He also made the wine. Alice is the only of her four siblings to join her dad in 2007. So she's been at this for a while. Alice, tell us a little about you and tell us about your journey since you joined your dad going back to 2007.
Well, the journey probably started before I was even conscious about
it.
But since when I was 15, I would have swore that I would never, ever join him, of course. But things changed because the passion about wine has been there for a long time. And I'm glad I joined him actually soon, sooner than later, because we have very many different works within a champagne house. We must learn how to beautifully grow grapes. We must learn how to vinify. We must learn then how to take care of the aging and hold the financial of all this inventory.
So,
a lot of jobs.
That's an important point for Paillard champagnes, because before, the family was just growing grapes.
Yes.
And I assume they were selling them to other producers. You, as you stated, are growing and vinifying the grapes and all of that.
Yes, well, and actually when my father started, he was not even growing because as often in French law, the family vineyards went to the elder brother of my grandfather. My grandfather was not the elder brother, and as such, he didn't inherit vineyards. So the starting point for my father was from zero.
He purchased.
Exactly. He had to purchase.
And then he acquired land.
Exactly.
Right.
And so he started by vinifying. And in time two, he could become a grower as well, which makes the profile of our house quite unusual, because we own, you know, a house owns little vineyard generally and buys a lot of fruit, and we are the opposite of that by owning.
Do you make about 50% of the wine is made from your own vineyards?
And even a bit higher, 65.
Is that typical of most champagne houses, or it varies, obviously?
No, it's really not. The average for a house is around 10%
ownership. Oh, so it's substantially higher.
Yes.
Just go back for a minute, because you said when you were 15, there's no way you're getting into the business. I just want to know, between 15 and when you decided, what was the defining moment that you decided, I guess I'm going to do this or give it a try? What happened?
I guess a certain internal peace with yourself first to start with, and a way of thinking, maybe I don't care so much about what people think, I care about what I want. And that's probably when it changed.
Wait, so it just didn't seem right or cool to go into the business because that's what you thought other people thought?
I couldn't stand the fact that people would tell me when I was 15, oh, you're going to work with your father. Yeah. When my parents would never, ever tell me that themselves. And I didn't like that idea.
So you've been with your dad, it's been, what, about 8-9 years?
Yeah, already, yeah.
So you obviously have a good relationship with him. When you initially decided to work with him,
you
guys had a good relationship.
We do.
And tell me now, do you work closely? Do you take separate tasks? You're both, very heavily into it?
Separate tasks is difficult because we're a small house. So at first I was really learning, and you're still learning every day, of course.
You never stop learning.
Exactly. But I was very much in his first step, job by job, mission by mission. Then there is a certain stage when you feel like your own view is a bit different, so you start working more on your own, which is the case. But now we're together on most subjects because it's a small house, so it's, you can't really split the work.
But when something is obvious that either needs to be innovated or changed, I mean, you'll be passionate about convincing your dad or you that we need to do this, even though it bucks tradition.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm very lucky. He's an easy person to work with because he's everything but the generation you would imagine, very reserved on changing things. He's always been a very proactive character, so it's never complex to convince him of any changes.
So in your tenure there, I think you alluded to it, you started at every level.
Yes.
I mean, you were out in the farm, the fields, you made wine, the cellars, which we'll talk about a little, which are not cellars at Paillard. It's above ground, right? All right, so let's talk about champagne. I mean, your life is surrounded by champagne, so there's nobody better to tell our listeners about champagne. So the first obvious question is, not all sparkling wine is champagne, correct?
Oh, not even. You know what, if you look at all sparkling wines produced around the world, champagne is not even 10% of it.
Okay, so what makes champagne champagne?
It's geography. The first thing you learn about wine, when you start learning about wine, you learn the definition of terroir. And terroir is the combination of a land, a climate, and people. And Champagne is before anything, a region, limited, which is northeast of Paris and the northern side of France. And actually, when you look at European vineyards, it's the most northern one. And it's very interesting to understand that because it's completely influences all the centuries of practices after that.
Right.
Geography has often explained history.
Right. Did they recently, I don't know how long ago, expand Champagne?
I understand where your question comes from. Expansion, no. Actually, revision of the map, absolutely. But Champagne has been reduced in the past. If you look at, you might have heard of phylloxera, which came from you, friends, our American friends. Phylloxera was
a vine disease that can devastate wines, grapes, vineyards, and all of that. That's what Alice is alluding to.
Yeah, because it came from America, and it arrived in Bordeaux in the end of the 19th century.
Malbec didn't do well with phylloxera and the cold and all that, so they didn't grow as much.
Exactly, and so all European vineyards, without exception, was completely destroyed by that. And it's interesting to observe, today's surface of Champagne appellation is 33,000 hectares. I'm sorry, I don't know in acres what it means. But before phylloxera, it used to be 80,000.
Oh, so
you see,
it wasn't replanted?
No.
Why? People just gave up, or?
A part of that, yes, absolutely, because a lot of families were absolutely ruined with phylloxera. And then people forget that First World War happened, and it happened there. The Marne battles, the Verdun, the Champagne was in the middle of it. And there was a moment of potential reconstruction of the Champagne vineyards, arrived First World War, arrived the Russian Revolution, arrived the crisis here in America. So all the export markets of Champagne were also completely closed,
right.
And it was a very, very tough time. So only a few people replanted bravely, if I can say that's correct English, to kind of defend the appellation, but a lot of it never was replanted.
So Champagne is Champagne because it is grown within a designated region.
Absolutely.
And as you said, the region was larger, and due to disease, phylloxera, it's shrunken down, but it's still a robust area. Within Champagne, do the terroirs, do the soils vary from one area to another, or it's generally, because you can go to Napa and on one winemaker's vineyard, he has lava, he has limestone, he's on a lake, and is the terroir different all over?
It's very interesting because Champagne is not very big, but it's very spread for the simple reason that because we're this very northern vineyard, the vine can only carry a nice and mature fruit on slopes. But someone who visited Champagne already realizes there are very few slopes. There are a lot of fields for kilometers, for miles of cereals and beetroots and potatoes. So, and then suddenly a hill and slopes and vines. So that means kind of small islands of vineyards,
right.
And so different realities of altitude, exposure, and soil.
What the slope helps with exposure,
uh-huh.
It just positions the vines and the grapes better.
It was a better sun exposure.
But Champagne is not very slopey or hilly, you're saying.
No, exactly.
Okay.
So, but there is the more beautiful and noble soil that we're looking for in Champagne is the chalk, the famous Belemnite chalk, which is nothing but the concretion of shells a million of years ago when it used to be a sea. But of course, you also have clay, you also have sand, you also have argile, you have various type of soil.
So different vines are growing in, some vines are growing in chalky soil, some are growing in limestone. But you blend, so you tend to get a mixture of the terroir. Is that fair?
You do blend, but what you will blend is up to your vision. You can choose not
to mix. Right, that's what makes Paillard. You're blending and all of that. All right, so let's talk about, so Champagne is a designated region. Anything outside of Champagne is not Champagne. It's a sparkling wine. So let's talk about how Champagne is made. I guess with regular wine, the grape is crushed, fermented, and aged. I think Champagne requires not different, but more steps.
Yes.
So tell me as simplistically as you can.
The beginning is exactly the same.
Growing grapes. Are we going
harvesting,
back that far?
Yeah.
Harvesting, growing.
Crushing separately and vinifying apart, not only grape by grape, but I'm speaking obviously of serious producers.
Right.
But village by village, and if possible, parcel by parcel, which is even better. And after a few months, it's, for us, we always do that much later because time matters. It's the moment of assemblage, the moment of tasting each of them and choosing
what.
When
you say later, you pick later?
No, we blend much later.
You blend later.
By
you
law,
hold on to the wine.
Exactly. By law, you can blend and bottle your wine as early as January after harvest. But if you want to make a good one, you need more time. It's impossible.
And time is money, so you're investing time, which costs money to produce what you feel is, you know, the wine that you want, which is a quality wine.
But to do a good assemblage, you need to taste not what you like right now, but what you anticipate the wine will become with a second fermentation, more years of aging. So if you don't give it enough time in the first place, you've no idea. It's like asking a 5 years old, kid, what do you want to do when you grow old? You know, you need to give it time.
Right.
Exactly. So, so this, for a serious producer, blending should happen in the spring. And then once you've decided your assemblage by, okay, let's put this village, etc., you physically do it, and then the wine is put inside the bottle. Whereas a second fermentation will happen the exact same way than the first fermentation. It's always sugar transforming into alcohol and producing CO2. But the difference is that this time it's in the sealed bottle, by opposition to an open barrel or tank.
Right.
So the CO2 that's produced cannot escape from the bottle, and it is dissolving into the wine. And because this CO2...
Does that have a name?
Second fermentation.
It's second, that's what it is. Second,
exactly.
Which is in bottle, closed, all the gases and everything.
And because the molecule of CO2 is bigger than the one of oxygen, it creates a pressure inside of the bottle. And that's the birth of the effervescence of champagne. And this second fermentation, it's extremely important that it happens in a cool cellar. This is why traditionally the older houses created 2 or 3 centuries ago had underground cellars, because it was the only way
to go. Cool.
Exactly.
Right.
Cool and stable. And so why is that? Because the cooler the temperature, the slower will be the second fermentation, and the more gentle and delicate the aromas will be in the bubble.
So you want slow, which is gentle, which benefits the final product.
Absolutely, and very, very creamy and tiny bubbles in the end. And
is tiny bubbles what you aim for?
Yes, always.
That's a finer champagne, tiny bubbles.
So very, very much so.
Go back for a second, because to make champagne, mm-hmm. you need grapes.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of grapes are we talking about?
Three main grapes are Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier.
So Chardonnay is a white grape, Pinot Noir is a red grape, and the third was?
Is Meunier is also
a red.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, we do make a white wine with 2 black grapes and 1 white grape.
That's a Blanc. De Blanc is all white.
Exactly. This is why, actually, harvest is mandatory by hand in Champagne, because to make sure the juice remains as clear as possible and doesn't get tainted by the color which lies in the skin of the grapes.
So if you do a rosé,
mm-hmm.
then you leave it on the skins
at some stage, absolutely, yeah.
When you do a rosé, you're using Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier?
It depends.
Okay.
You can also use Chardonnay.
You can?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. There's color in the skin to give it a little rosé quality?
You necessarily need some black grape, but I mean, you can also have some Chardonnay in the blend if you want to.
So the champagnes you make are blends?
Absolutely.
Do you do a Blanc de Blanc?
We do.
And then you blend. Do you blend all three?
Ah, all right. The notion of, that's a good point you're raising. Blend or assemblage. Relates to several things in champagne. Before anything, assemblage of terroirs. Before the assemblage of grapes, you start by assembling parcels, which is what makes me say our Blanc de Blanc is an assemblage. Because, yes, you're right, it is only one grape, actually, but it is 8 different terroirs. And also assemblage of different vintages together.
Right, which we'll get to.
Uh-huh.
So, do you follow, do the wines, the champagnes, is there a similar structure historically as far as the assemblage, you know, from different terroirs, or is it drastically different every time? I mean, you have to sort of stick to a formula, right? And then you tweak it, or does it really vary vintage to vintage?
I know. It's exactly like a composition. If you take a Beethoven symphony, for instance, it was conceived and written once, but then it is reinterpreted every time with a different orchestra, different instruments, in different cities or places to play the music. It's exactly the same thing. The secret of each assemblage has been created once, but then you need to reinterpret it every vintage, every year, with what Mother Nature gives you, with the characteristic of each village, and the art of it is about replacing the right village by the other right village in terms of if you've had hail, if you had spring frost, if right. you just didn't agree with the character developed by that terroir.
That's very personal.
And that's where it, right. the creativity comes in.
Right. Which makes every wine different, every vintage and all of that. What, you have a thing called a pound a cup during crushing. Do you know what that is?
No.
You use the best juice.
Ah, yes.
To explain that.
Well,
when you crush the grapes, there's a certain amount of juice, and you use...
That's for us, Bruno Paillard.
Right, not everyone does that, no, which exactly. is another point towards quality.
But of course, I mean, that's quite intuitive. I think everybody gets that the first part of the pressing is the purest one, because you really extract what's in the heart of the grape, and while the second part of the pressing, you start crushing a bit the seeds and the skin and the rafle, as we say in French. So obviously in the second part of the pressing, you extract a bit of bitterness, which is interesting because when you just taste them at the very moment, one might prefer the second pressing because right. it's softer. But remember, we are aiming for something not that we like now, but what will become right. a beautiful wine later on.
So do people use a good amount of the second pressing, or most better champagne stay away from it? I know you do.
Usually that's a question to ask to each.
Right, that's not a fair question, but it will appear.
But what I can say is we commit to using only the first right. one, and we write it on each bottle.
All right, so let's talk about some of these nerdy terms. Let's talk about what disgorgement is.
All right, so I will just go back a couple of minutes when we were talking of the process,
right.
bottling and second fermentation in a cool cellar. This second fermentation...
The wine is in the bottle, exactly. closed, sealed, the gases probably. Are sealed. That's the second fermentation.
Exactly, and in a cool cellar. And that's... Then you kind of hold on everything and you stop and you wait. Because the
How long are we talking about leaving the wine
in the second
fermentation in the bottle?
Alors, that's obviously there is a minimum set by law, which would say 15 months for a non-vintage champagne and 3 years for a single vintage champagne. And then obviously the law only sets a minimum. And again, if you want to make a serious wine, you need more time.
Time only benefits the quality.
Yes. If the first material in, right. in the bottle can right. can stand it, of course. For us, a younger wine would be 3 years on lees. And why is that important?
Tell people what lees are.
Voilà. Because the second fermentation won't last for 3 years. Even in a very cool cellar, it will be completed in 2 to 3 months. But what happens next? These yeast that have done the second fermentation, they are alive. So they've consumed all the sugar, they've transformed it into alcohol. They've consumed all the oxygen, they've released CO2. And once they've done that, they die because they have nothing right. else to nourish them. And one could think they're useless. But they're not. They become lees. They become these famous sediments that lay on the bottle horizontally. And they are like a very thin couverture, if I could say. And they then start this famous and very mysterious process of the autolysis. Autolysis is this self-destruction of the lees into tinier and tinier and invisible pieces that will mysteriously enrich the wine, nourish it, give it structure and body.
So the visible lees disappear?
They don't completely disappear.
Completely.
But some part of it do and nourish the wine. And that's when, by leaving the wines on lees in the cellar for a long time, you give them more structure. And the thing is, obviously, when we consider the aging is over, we're not going to give you a champagne bottle with sediment inside.
Right.
So that's when disgorgement comes in. because we need to get rid of the sediment in the end of the process.
So disgorgement is the process of getting rid of the sediment.
Absolutely.
So that you have, is it filtering or?
No, it's the bottle is laying down in the cellar for years. Then you have a short riddling process of a couple of weeks.
Explain what riddling is.
And riddling is simply the fact of bringing the bottle from horizontal to vertical position, head down, simply to verify.
In racks.
Yes.
And you have cellars with bottles.
Absolutely.
Pointed down.
And so that very, very gently, the sediments will move towards the exit door, which is the neck of the bottle. And when they're absolutely ready, you have to do it quietly.
So that makes disgorgement easier by moving the sediment.
Exactly.
Up.
They are all concentrated nearby.
Riddling used to be, not used to, it was done by hand. Mm-hmm. I understand you have mechanical riddlers?
Yes.
Or some?
Well, riddling's been done by hands for a very, very long time. The thing is, you don't find anybody who wants to do that anymore.
No.
So
it's mechanical?
Tough. It's a very not fun job at all.
So the wines are put in a large pallet and a machine.
There's a combination of two things. Yeah, first, nobody wants to do it. But also, the riddling racks have been delivering beautiful quality results because they do very. Riddling is not what makes a good wine, but if it's not well made,
it's just the process to get.
But
the
if it's not well made, it can ruin a good wine.
Right.
So it's very important. And the key to a good riddling is the size of the movement that need to be very small. And the number of
the actual movement of the bottle.
Exactly.
So that's a very precise.
The smaller they are, and the more
you just can't have somebody come in and start spinning bottles around.
No, exactly. And the more
I
numerous,
I would have gotten fired.
The more numerous they will be, the brightest will the wine be in the end. So that's why that's what explains the success of Giro Palette in Champagne because they do that better than by hand.
All right. So let's keep the process going. So now the wine is in the bottle, second fermentation, pointed down, riddled to move the sediment up. It's ready for what now?
The famous disgorgement. The fact of opening the bottle a few seconds, letting some wines run through and together bring sediments, and then putting it up again and making sure no more wine is coming out. And because you've lost a bit of wine in the process, you need to top it up.
Right.
So you top it up with your reserve wines and the dosage that you've chosen to do.
Dosage is what?
And dosage is the level of sugar. Some wines are, you've heard of extra brut, brut champagne, demi-sec, sec.
Those are all levels of dryness.
Exactly.
But is dosage adding sugar?
It's adding reserve wines with a bit of sugar inside.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So how much you add determines how dry.
Exactly.
Okay.
For us, they're all extra bruts, which means very, very little dosage.
And one of the things you said a few times is longer maturation.
Yeah.
You, Paillard, is very patient. Quality is important, so you're willing to let wine sit there a lot longer.
The thing is, you can choose between time and sugar. Basically, I'm a bit hard saying that, but if you want to seek for purity and low dosage in your wines, which is what we're doing, you need time because the first material has a very vibrant nervosity and acidity, and I use this word knowing that it's a scary word. Acidity, people are scared about that sensation that can be aggressive.
I think once they understand what it is,
exactly.
They realize it helps with food.
Exactly.
It gives the wine that feel. The term sounds intimidating, but it's important to what a good champagne or wine
exactly.
is.
Exactly, and it depends all on how it's integrated.
Right.
You can choose to hide acidity with sugar. We'd rather not do that. We'd rather domesticate, civilize acidity with time, hence the importance of the aging.
So Paillard is an innovator in some areas. You were the first to put disgorgement dates on the bottles.
Yes.
People weren't really doing that.
Absolutely.
Right.
My father Bruno had this observation. We've all done that. You're a party of six, you go to the restaurant, you order a bottle of a champagne you like very much, it's delicious, you say, well, let's have a second bottle half hour later, and it's a second bottle from the exact same house, and you have the feeling to drink a different champagne. And very legitimately, you could think, well, that's not serious. Why would I have two different impressions?
So by matching the disgorgement gauge,
exactly,
will give you the
exactly, because maybe simply because one bottle was a disgorgement from previous delivery a year ago,
so that
and
was
not
for the
other
consumer.
One. Exactly.
Just to give them more information.
Absolutely.
All right, we were talking about cellars, riddling, and all that. You built a state-of-the-art above-ground cellar, which is where you store your wines?
It is, because...
When did you do that?
In 1990.
Okay.
Yeah, because, well, we never tried to make a fake old cellar. It was more about using the best of techniques to
right.
have to offer the best possible aging environment.
Right.
And the thing is, when you're if you choose to go underground, it means you have different levels of cellars, one underneath the other. And the problem doing that is that each level will have a different temperature. The best ideal temperature
this
is only
uniformly controlled.
Exactly.
What you did.
Otherwise, you need to go 35 right. meters underground to find the 10 and a half Celsius degrees
right.
we are looking for.
And we talked about the mechanical pallets, which mm-hmm. you adopted fairly early.
Yeah, because it was at the same time that the building of the cellar.
Right.
So it
made sense to automate there. And Bruno Paillard Champagne is still an independent, family-owned.
Entirely, 100%.
Which is not the case with a lot of champagne houses mm-hmm. that roll off people's mm-hmm. tongues, which is a nice thing. And you take a holistic approach to the business, right? Would you say that's a fair description?
I'll say you're well-informed.
Okay. All right, so that's how we make champagne. That's how Bruno Paillard makes champagne. They do a bunch of things different, time. Some of their approaches. Did we miss anything?
Oh, no, but I could keep speaking for hours,
right.
but I guess.
We'll move on to something else. I do a thing every week. It's called the wine list.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't prompt you on this because I didn't want you to prepare. I'm going to ask you about 5 questions about wine. Now, it's tricky with you because you can answer with champagne and wine. So I'll prompt you as to what wines are you drinking right now? So... Not champagne.
Not champagne, all right.
Just now, not,
no,
you know,
yeah,
has it been seasonal? Is there something you're loving?
Oh, what I love, as far as whites are concerned, if not champagne, I love to go to the Moselle.
German wines.
And some wonderful Riesling.
I think Riesling is very underrated for
wine.
And the value is very good.
But if I go to reds, I would love the... from the Rhone, I tend to go more either Northern Rhone, Saint-Joseph, or also Southern
like
Rhone.
Syrahs, bold Syrah.
Yeah, but then the Northern Rhone, you have a lot of elegance too. You have maturity with refinement if you find the right producers. And looking at the Southern Rhone, you have some very interesting things like in Ventoux, for instance, which is more Grenache, but here you have Clos de Trias, for instance, which I like very much. Coming into the winter, these are wines that are very, very interesting.
All right, your favorite wine and food pairing. Uh-huh. So we'll all say champagne and oysters, but now what's your favorite wine and food pairing?
Oh, am I allowed to reply with champagne because it really
yes,
is?
Yes, on this one you can. So what's your favorite champagne food pairing?
I'll be joking on that because this summer I had an amazing pairing I had never realized. It was just after a bath in the sea, a cup of rosé, première cuvée, and I still had some salt on my lips. And that was a wonderful pairing, a sea bath with a glass of rosé champagne.
That could be on the top 5 of most interesting answers. How about your favorite wine restaurant or wine bar? And I'm going to give you 2 ways to answer. You're in New York now, and New York's a pretty damn good restaurant town, and you've also been in France, which is a great restaurant country in Europe. Do you have a favorite restaurant that you go into that has great wine service and the food and pairing everything?
Of course there are, but for me it's difficult to reply for New York because I haven't come in 2 years.
Okay, so then tell me at home or Europe.
Oh yeah, well, at home in Paris, I live in France, but in Paris I see a lot of energy in new places opening and absolutely place like like Le Bon 5%, for instance, which is a bistro, but which was rated the very best bistro last year by the Foodie
in
Paris.
In Paris?
Yes, it's
what's it called?
Le Bon 5%.
Okay.
It's really a place. I mean, you want to eat typical French cuisine
with wine service?
Exactly.
Okay.
With great wine service in an absolutely not pretentious area in the heart of Paris behind Saint-Sulpice. It's so beautiful.
Nice.
It's really a nice address to try.
Not fancy,
casual. Yeah,
Okay.
Absolutely. You had another question, which was
favorite wine restaurant or wine bar.
Yeah.
You answered it. We're going to move to the next one. Favorite all-time wine. So you get two answers. Favorite all-time champagne, and then is there a wine? Is it a birth year wine? Did you have is there a wine that just still resonates with you?
Yes. Alors, if I start with a non-champagne, it would probably be a 1982 Brand Cantenac.
Really?
Which...
Great producer, not one of the, Grand Cru. I like to hear that.
I don't know if you can still find
82 was a... Right. You can. You just have to pay for it.
Yeah.
But a great vintage year. What about your all-time favorite champagne? I mean, the house has been around for...
You know what? Well, the thing I think that gave me most, the striking one probably would have been the 96 Blanc de Blanc, which is a wine very deep, very vertical, very energetic, so that creates kind of extreme emotions. But in competition to that, the most memorable one I have tasted would be a very apparently simple Première Cuvée, which was disgorged 20 years ago. And that is extremely, creates a lot of emotion to understand how a non-pretentious wine,
right,
how far it can go.
Right. We're going to taste the wine. We do a thing called the weekly wine sip. And you were kind enough to bring a Paillard champagne. And we're going to break in a minute. But I forgot to get to one area which is important to Bruno Paillard. And people know wine as vintage wines. You know, here's a 1982, here's a 2002. But a lot of wine people purchase is non-vintage. You call it something else. You call it multi-vintage, which is brilliant because explain what a multi-vintage is. You know, that the house has all these vintages and they mix.
The thing with non-vintage is we don't like that term so much for two reasons. The first one is that it's negative, and the second one is that it doesn't mean what the wine is. It just means what it's not. It comes from the opposition to a vintage. A single vintage champagne is a wine made exclusively from one harvest, while a multi-vintage is a wine made from several different vintages together. And in as far as we're concerned,
of which you have reserves of
exactly
these vintages.
This is what
for blending
the reserve ones.
So your current non-vintage can have wines blended from as far back as when?
In our case, as far back as 85.
Okay. I think that's a pretty nice thing when you're picking up a...
That's unique, actually, in champagne, absolutely.
All right, so that covers multi-vintage. All right, we're going to do our weekly wine sip. You'll stay and you'll join in drinking, and I want you to kind of walk us through the wine. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For this week's weekly wine sip, Alice Paillard from Champagne Bruno Paillard will join us for the wine sip, and she has brought us a bottle of champagne. We'll be tasting the mixed vintage Bruno Paillard Extra Brut Champagne. So let's pop it open, pour it, and tell me a little about this wine.
Here we are, Sam. Watch out. Here we are.
The best part was when your beautiful hair kind of poofed. That was nice. That's a visual you won't get on here.
There's a lot of life in the bottle.
Yes.
Well, this wine is called Première Cuvée, which stands for first pressing.
Okay.
We mentioned earlier the notion of the importance of the first part of the pressing. Alors, first thing is, of course, if you can choose a glass, the ideal shape is what we call the tulip shape, which is a V in the bottom part, which allows the bubbles to grow, and a larger belly in the center so that there is enough aeration for the
wine. So flutes are passé.
Actually, the tulip is a type of flute that would be a mixture between the straight flute and a Burgundy glass, ideally.
Right.
So here...
So the color is...
Well, first you can look. If you have the proper glass, you will see a nice effervescence. That's very, very tiny. We learn to look at the color of a wine on something white. And here you see, we call it a straw gold color, which means it's a fairly yellow gold that shows the presence of black grapes as well as white grape.
Right.
But then also use something black to see the bubbles, because when they're very, very small, they appear like tiny white dots and almost invisible
in
the wine. So you see them better.
You see different things against the darker.
Exactly.
All right, so let's take a sniff.
Oh, sniff, absolutely. Thanks for smelling it first. I appreciate that.
I think that's very important.
It is, because it's...
So it has a very prominent nose. Mm-hmm. Now describe to me what we're getting in the nose. I know what I'm getting, but I want to hear it from you.
The thing is, and I feel that smelling it is a part of the pleasure, too. So the first nose is a bit more dominated with citrus, which come from the Chardonnay, but soon after... You have a bit of the rounder fruit of the Pinot, a bit of the red currants, and a bit of the blackberry, and a bit of the spicy notes as well that are
arriving. So you're getting citrus,
mm-hmm.
you're getting some black fruit,
mm-hmm.
you're getting some red fruit.
Mm-hmm. And a bit of spiciness coming
from
gently.
Where? From any particular grape?
It could be from the Pinot more.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's taste. So we
Cheers.
Want good health. We want to talk about mouthfeel, the bubbles, mm-hmm. the effervescence, the acidity, and then flavor.
Absolutely. They're
delicious. Okay. So what are we tasting?
First, there are three moments important in the mouth. The arrival of the wine on the palate, which we call the attack, and then the central sensation when it's in the middle of the mouth.
The palate.
Exactly. And the finish.
This is a long finishing chant. Mm-hmm. I still have.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
I mean, I got the attack and the mid-palate, but it's a few seconds later, it's still sitting there.
I hope you would agree that the attack is quite frank, a bit sharp, but not aggressive. And then real rich presence on the palate with a slight salivation on side and very long and persistent with an almost salty finish, which is a bit surprising.
Not overpowering salty, but a little salinity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
More salinity than
salt,
because
right.
when you think of salt, you think of
no, you're
on
right.
top of French fries or something.
No, not at all.
Which is not what we're thinking.
But it's all about looking for the balance between a substance and real character on the palate, but in an elegant manner, not in a heavy manner.
What grapes are in this champagne?
You have a touch of Meunier, 22%, a lot of Pinot Noir, 45%, and 33% Chardonnay.
Okay, so it's a blend of all those grapes. Availability, we checked. This is a champagne that is available at most and better wine and liquor stores. The retail on this is approximately how much?
Approximately $50.
So it's a $50 bottle of champagne that I think drinks for, you know, what tastes like considerably more money. So this is the mixed vintage, which you will now use in your vocabulary because you're going to drop non-vintage.
Too melty.
Because Alice told you that it's a negative term, and I think she's right. It's the mixed vintage Bruno Paillard Extra Brut Champagne. All right, thank you for bringing that, Alice. Finally, wait, did you want to say something? All right, so we're going to wrap up the show. Finally, to find out about great wine events and tastings in your area, go to localwineevents.com and plug into your city. There's a diversity of interesting wine events every week. If you have a wine happening or event or something interesting, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation. We will also post Alice's wine list answers, and we will post the weekly wine sip, the champagne we tasted, and we'll give you some of the descriptors. Thank you, Alice, for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Sam.
You really upped our knowledge of champagne, and we appreciate that. Thank you, Alice Paillard, co-director of Champagne Bruno Paillard. Thank you to our engineer, Pierre, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. Go to heritageradionetwork.org for more info. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.